This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Welcome to Business Made Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the insurance industry's leading education and events provider, ANZIF, via their Careers in Insurance initiative. I'm Mark Silvera.
Susie Leung is a lawyer by trading and Zurich's chief claims officer. As a first-generation Australian, the child of Vietnamese boat migrants, Susie says, I'm going to start that all over again.
Yeah, that's fine.
Hey, thanks for dialing into Business Made Personal. Susie Leung is with us today. She is a lawyer by training and Zurich's chief claims officer. As a first-generation Australian, the child of Vietnamese boat migrants, Susie says her parents just wanted her to get into university, obtain a degree, and work an office job. Well, you've certainly done that, Susie. No doubt about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about being the child of Vietnamese boat migrants. You know, when you think back to those early years, what was it like for you growing up?
Yeah, when I think back to those early years, I just think about how incredibly hard my parents worked. You know, so my dad was working either afternoon or night shifts in the factory. And the reason why he worked those, the night shifts in particular, was because one, it freed him up to be available during the day for us as a family, you know, to do the school runs, but also because, you know, those shifts paid more. So I remember he just kept very odd hours. I would be home from school and dad would be getting ready to go off to work, you know, and so he'd be there in the morning to take us to school. So it was just incredible amount. And mum was at home, you know, looking after us, but she was also sewing, you know, doing some seamstress work at home as well. Sewing machines, you know, the ones that are built into the desk, they weigh an absolute ton. She had one of those in the garage. And one of my earliest memories is actually sitting on the garage floor doing sums. She gave me all this mathematics, doing sums on the garage floor while she was sewing. And I don't even know how old I was, but definitely before school started. So that was before kindergarten.
So thinking back on those days, you know, I'm obviously the son of migrants. We migrated to Australia when I was 9. Did you have a sense that, you know, you were poor? Did you have that sort of feeling around, you know, other people had things that you didn't?
Not at first. And then as I got older, yes. My parents worked so hard. They sent us to a good school, a good Catholic school, local Catholic school. And, you know, I had everything I needed in terms of school uniform and bag and shoes and all that kind of stuff. I knew that I probably didn't get as, like, you know, also we didn't grow up with Santa per se. So I knew that, you know, there were other kids that had different experiences than I did. Certainly when people came back from summer holidays and talked about how they went off to Australia Wonderland or they went on holidays, I was like, oh, okay, well, I kind of just stayed at home during the holidays. I didn't really go away. I didn't really do much in that regard. So I certainly became aware of those experiences as we got older, but really it was just a case of less so about the money, but more about the time, right? My parents were just so busy working all the time that we didn't, you know, take holidays and I didn't think about the money aspect that we probably couldn't afford to do those things. I just thought about how they were so busy working all the time and that's why we couldn't do those things.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. I mean, my parents, you know, we came to this country with $50 between 3 kids and 2 adults. You know, holidays were not really part of our agenda. In fact, my folks never owned a house or a car, whereas a lot of other people did. And I guess from a migrant perspective, you know, those early years, did it instill any sort of behaviours that you've carried on in your business life?
For sure. Definitely work ethic. You know, seeing how hard my parents worked. And then my dad just always said to us as we were growing up, work hard, work hard, work hard when you're young, be disciplined in what you do and how you approach things. And, you know, it was just a constant mantra to us is, you know, work hard and then you can enjoy the fruits of your labor early rather than struggle for your entire life. So that was something that was very much instilled into us. And we didn't just have that told to us. We saw that every day. We saw our parents do that. So, yeah, it was that and also something else that really stuck with me or instilled something very strongly in me is sense of family. You know, there was not a day where our house was like, it was like an open door between ours and our extended family, cousins, aunts, grandparents. You know, every weekend when my parents weren't working, we were spending time with extended family. Lots of, you know, I grew up with my cousins and that was just beautiful. I'm very, very close to my family. Even to this day as adults, I have three brothers. We have a group chat that we talk on every day, even though we're all adults now and live different lives. And extended family get-togethers, the importance of family dinners every Sunday night, we go over to mum and dad's for dinner. We bring along our partners, our children, and that is very important to me as well. So those two things is probably sense of family and work ethic are the two things from my childhood and my upbringing that I still very, very much hold passionately to this day.
I wanted to ask you about that sort of sense of family that you mentioned. I read at the introduction that, you know, your parents didn't want you to get into a labor type role. Mm-hmm. Did you feel you had to follow their wishes? And
absolutely. I think it was, I felt a lot of pressure, you know, throughout my higher school years, definitely felt an enormous amount of pressure to do well in school, to focus on academics, you know. So it's amazing now as an adult, do I have hobbies? No, probably not. I don't play any musical instruments. I'm not creatively minded. I love reading, but that's probably an offshoot of academia. I'm not sporty. I don't do any of those things. And it's just because as I was growing up, I was so focused on studying and doing really, really well in that. So an enormous amount of pressure in high school, in my latter years, pressure that I felt my parents placed on me, but pressure I felt that I put on myself to not want to disappoint my family as well or disappoint my parents. I was always doing good at school, did very well, worked hard, you know, always had the word conscientious in my school report. That still applies to this day if you were to rate my performance. I did. Yeah, felt an enormous amount of pressure and that pressure was to get into university, right? Like it was a case of my parents really did not want us to live a life that they were living and working physically demanding jobs. They wanted us to use our brains. They wanted us to make the most of the opportunities Australia had afforded us as a family, make the most of a big move, you know, for a family to get onto a rickety boat in the middle of the night and sail across the seas. They're doing that out of desperation and the want of something better for their children. So it was a realization of that dream, a realization of that hope, I suppose, that they really wanted for us. So yes, enormous amount of pressure to go to university. Typical Asian parents were like, be a doctor or a lawyer. I chose law because I love reading, absolutely love words, and I love the power of words, and I love analytical thinking. And that was something that I was very well suited to. So to the extent where even in year 12, when I did my university admissions, you know how you can put your selection, you can have like 10 choices. I only put 3. I was so determined to get into law into 3 universities in particular. And that was it. I was not doing anything else. God knows what I would have done if I didn't make it. But luckily, I did not have to face that situation.
And you're the sort of person I hated at school. Disciplined, smart, you know, got a plan in mind. I had none of those, I got to tell you. I want to talk about the legal qualifications. So you ended up becoming a lawyer.
Yes.
So what happened after that? You went out, did you get yourself a gig somewhere?
I think my career started even before that. So I did a combined degree, a business and a law degree. And while I was studying, I had first started working for a suburban solicitor, just as he's like, you know, secretary, basically. I was doing mail. I was banking checks. I was running to the bank. I was running errands. I was ordering stationery. I was answering the phone. I was just the general gopher. I thought it was really, again, me, disciplined and planned, thought that it would be really good to graduate because I knew how competitive it was to graduate ahead with some experience under my belt rather than just study. So I did that for a couple of years. And then from there, I actually wanted to move to a big organization. And so I saw this job for Zurich Insurance, who I'd never heard of before, TTP claim, and I applied for it. And I applied for it because I also thought, wow, that's a multinational organization and I would love the opportunity to move overseas one day and to work overseas and travel and all sorts of things. And I knew that that could be quite limiting in law because, as you know, your practicing certificate is only relevant to the state that you're in, not even the country that you're in. So I just thought, well, maybe I'm going to try to build skill set in that area as well. That said, I'm still fully committed to graduating and to being a lawyer. It was just something that I did. So I worked at Zurich as a CCP claims advisor while I studied at night. I did that for, I think it was 2 years. And then I was offered a job to be a lawyer when I graduated. And as much as I loved the culture and my experience, my first big multinational organization, I took the job in law because I thought, this is what I studied for. This is what my parents wanted me to be. They didn't raise me to be a CCP claims advisor. They raised me to be a lawyer. So I took
a doctor.
So I took the graduate role and went off to practice law. So my career has been, that's how I started my career, was I worked even throughout university while I was studying, just really trying to get any sort of experience on the books, because my parents didn't let me have the McDonald's jobs in high school because they wanted me to be focused on study. So I had zero distractions. I had no teenage job, and I knew that I needed to get some type of real life practical work experience before I graduated.
And so you end up in the law. Then how did you end up back at Zurich?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I ended up in the law, and to be honest, I really enjoyed it. There was nothing there that I didn't really dislike, right? I was a junior lawyer. I was with a bunch of other junior lawyers, and it was a lot of fun. You're in it together. You're studying. You're doing your practical legal experience. You're turning up to court. You're sharing anecdotes about how particularly judges or registrars cut us down and we're terrified of them, of bad court cases, of bad clients, you know, or difficult clients, whatever it may be. I found it quite fun, but there was probably two things that I made me decide, maybe this is not for me. Number one was I still had that dream of working overseas. I still had that dream of travel. And probably that was part of my upbringing because I never holidayed and I never traveled and I never did anything. So I just saw the world as this huge, scary, but also super exciting place out there. And as long as I could remember, I had wanted to go to Europe. Because for me, it was just all that history, all that culture, such that was something I wanted to see. And the most furthest point from Sydney, Australia, and that's where I wanted to go. So there was that dream. And the other thing was really culture and opportunity is probably what I would say. From my taste of insurance, when I worked there for 18 months, 2 years, while I was still studying, I loved the culture. Very team-based culture, very open culture, not hierarchical as compared to law. And I loved that it was very open and conducive to learning. You know, so open plan office, you can sit there, you realize you've got no idea what the hell this is. You can literally just turn very casually to the person sitting next to you and just be like, hey, Mark, can I ask you a dumb question? Whereas as a junior lawyer sitting in my little shoebox cabinet of an office, I felt incredibly daunted to ask questions because I would have to get up, leave my office, go knock on the closed door of somebody else to ask them a question. And also in a legal environment, it's highly competitive. So you don't also want to show weakness. So I would actually be more reluctant to ask questions and try to find the answer out for myself. Whereas in insurance, I just kind of was like, yeah, the culture was so good and such a, we're all in this together, we're a team, anyone can ask anything, very psychologically safe space. So yeah. And then the other thing was opportunity. I was working in law and I just thought, okay, so what comes next is I work up to being an associate and then I do a few years and then I'll become a senior associate and then up to senior associate, you know, then you become special counsel or partner. And okay, so I have to plug at the same thing but increasing complexity day in, day out for the next however many years to move up the ladder. And I realized one day as I was walking to the train station about to hop on the train to come into the office, I don't actually want to be partner of a law firm. And then I thought, God, if you don't want the end goal, what the hell are you doing? Why are you here? And I examined why I didn't want to be partner or why I thought I didn't want to be partner. And for me, it came down to I have an enormous thirst for learning. I get bored very easily. I know that I am motivated by new things, challenges, and do I want to become the technical expert at something and one subject matter, and in law you pick a specialty and you stick with it, right? Whether it be construction or litigation or contracts or corporations or whatever it is, you tend to pick something and become really, really, really good at it. And I just thought, God, if I have to do the same thing day in, day out, same subject matter for my entire career, I don't think I'm going to be happy. And that's what made me go, yeah, I think it's time to get out of law.
So you make the decision, you go and meet your folks who wanted you to be a lawyer or a doctor.
Yes.
How did that conversation go, Susie?
I'm now an executive at an insurance company and they still lament to me, why are you not a lawyer? I don't know how to explain this to you, Mum and Dad, but you have to trust me that this is better. You just have to trust me that this is actually, yeah, better. They got it. I think for them it was really in all honesty, what they wanted for me was security. It wasn't a label of doctor or a lawyer. They just thought that those things would give me financial security. They just wanted financial security. They wanted to know that I was doing something where I would be able to live life comfortably without struggling, that I could raise a family without struggle the way that they had. You know, I see my parents 3-4 times a week still, but that was all they wanted for me. It wasn't the label of you must be a doctor or a lawyer. It was that financial security that I can go do those things and buy those things without worrying about it.
And, you know, my folks were about, you need to get into the bank or you need to get into the army because, and again, they saw it as security, right?
Yeah.
So we've talked about your parents' challenges in life. If I had to say to you, what's been the hardest challenge in your life that you've had, what would you say?
Two things. One was when I had my first child, and that was she's almost 10. So that was, close to 10 years ago. And I don't know what I was thinking. You know, I remember being pregnant and thinking, yes, I'm ready for this, and I know exactly what I'm doing, and I know how my career is going to play out after this as well. So I was very like, yep, I'm going to have this baby, take a year off, and then return to work on a part-time basis because that seems to be what you do, right? You do part-time. I hated part-time work. I really did. It's not the construct or anything like that. It was me. It was me. I felt like I was neither 100% here or 100% there. I felt like I was being overlooked for opportunities. When I was working, I felt like I was labelled the young mother who's probably likely to go off and have another child soon. She's in the growing family phase and therefore not looked at for opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. It was really difficult because I had been somebody who had been very career-driven before that, and I had seen my career grow in leaps and bounds, and I had realised my dreams of working overseas. I had worked with Zurich overseas in Switzerland. I worked in North America. I'd done cool projects, I'd done really diverse, amazing work, and then all of a sudden it ground down to a halt. And I don't know whether it ground down to a halt because of my own choice, because I obviously had a child, so that was my choice, or because I felt unseen, or maybe a combination of both. But I really struggled with that. And people who were your peers before, accelerate ahead of you, I struggled with that. So, yeah, so that was one really difficult time in my life. Second difficult time in my life was actually when the same daughter who grew up a little bit, we had moved back from America. We lived in America for some time for my husband's work, and we moved back from America, and inexplicably upon a few weeks of landing in Australia, her hair just started falling out in clumps, you know, and we just could not understand how, why. She was emotionally very distressed about leaving America, where she had considered to be her home. And it was just a really hard time for our family, you know, where it was just, sorry, I still get emotional.
No, don't worry. I totally understand where you're coming from, because as a parent, you always want to do the right thing by your child. When you do something that they don't necessarily agree with and you get that sort of reaction, it can be quite challenging for sure.
And fear for your child of being different.
100%.
So that was something that definitely was challenging for us during that time.
Yeah. Was it diagnosed as a short-term problem or?
She was diagnosed with alopecia. Right. And she lost all her hair. She lost her eyebrows. She lost so much. And that was difficult. And just talking to her through this process was, and trying to shield her from judgments and questions, and that was hard.
Absolutely. And, you know, those sorts of things when you're a young child, as adults, we've got filters, right? If you see someone with no hair, you tend to go, okay, and probably not say anything. When you're with other children, they've got no filter.
But to be honest, like, the kids were actually great. They were, because they were so young at this stage, but they were curious more than malicious.
Yeah.
So they'd just be like, what's happening with your hair? Like, just outright, I would just say it. I just taught her to be very matter-of-fact about it as well. I said to her, it's like how some people have nut allergies. Something that happens to some people and we can't do anything about it, and that's just the way it is. And I was trying to teach her that the more casual in her response about it, that would influence how others would react to her as well. That was an interesting time in our lives.
It just brings back a couple of memories for me, because I migrated 4 years after the White Australia policy, so there weren't too many brown-skinned people running around. Yeah. And I remember someone asking me if I'd got burnt somewhere or the other because I was so brown.
Yeah.
And I look back now, and at the time, it was quite a painful experience because you're 100% right. You're really different to everybody else. Now I can look back and laugh on it, but I wasn't laughing at the time. I could say, I could tell you.
And as a child, you just want to fit in, right?
Oh, like 100%.
You just want to fit in. And that was my biggest fear for her, was because we moved back to Australia. The school year had already started. She was moving into a new school already. She didn't know anyone. She had this very curious American accent. And she also had, like, she was half balding at the same time. You know, so it was just a case of, oh, my Lord, like, all of those factors coming together did not make the greatest start for any child who just wants to fit in. And you just, so that was a hard time. But again, the power of family, you know, came through in terms of being there to support. And, you know, and she's great. I mean, she has hair again, but she still has bald spots that come up. And it's actually really interesting. It's a telltale sign for me that she's stressed out or upset about something internally that she's actually not telling us about. So she's somebody who very internalizes things. My second daughter is very vocal. So anything on her mind she's upset about, she will tell you straight away. Whereas my eldest one is very stoic. She wants to make it out like everything's in her control and she's okay and she takes everything in her stride. But clearly there's emotions boiling under the surface. So it's actually now my flag, red flag, to be like, okay, something's not okay with her.
Yeah.
So learning your children, I suppose. But that was definitely the first time in my life where I was just like, I have been so blessed to this day, you know, in terms of understanding that I've had a very smooth childhood with a very, yes, it was hard with my parents working all the time, but they did everything they could to give me all of the tools and security to help succeed, and then forging my career, university, opportunities I'd had. I just realized how blessed I was. When
Absolutely.
Something like that happens and makes me go, and for all of those amazing career and everything, and what really matters was family, right?
And I guess that's one of the things I love about the insurance industry. It's almost like you've got a work family as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I had gone back to work at the same time that this was happening. And I just remember, you know, an industry of people who genuinely care. They care about each other. They care about what we're trying to do for the community, because we're an industry to service the community, right? Incredibly supportive, whatever time I needed, anything I wanted in terms of going, I need to be at appointments, I need to do this, I need to do that. It was very, very understanding of that. And yes, I mean, you know, we bring our whole selves into work, you know, and it's amazing that we can support each other in that kind of way. And I've always brought my whole self into work. So culturally as well, I remember when I became an executive for the first time, someone actually said to me in the lift, it's great to see diversity on our executive team, not just gender diversity, but cultural diversity as well. And so I thought that was nice. You know, that was really nice. And to be representing people.
I think, to be fair though, you know, diversity is awesome, but you need the right people in the position. So, you know, obviously you're really good at what you do. Otherwise, you just wouldn't be in the position. I wanted to ask you, in an article by ANZIF, you said, I will quote you, when people understand the goals of an organization, its values, its strategy, and the role they as an individual play in contributing to those, You have the buy-in, and that is critical for retaining talent and building succession, end of quote. The question I've got for you, Susie Loom, Chief Claims Officer at Zurich, what do you see as the challenges of people buying in today?
The challenges are, I think there's a couple of different facets to this. One is values is so important, okay? So especially the younger generation that is coming through, they're not motivated by things such as security, as my parents were motivated by. They're not motivated by status, climbing the corporate ladder, getting to partnership level, getting to executive level. They're not motivated by the same thing that previous generations have been motivated by. And that's because they've grown up in a time where there's been enormous security and fortune around, right? No big world wars, you know, no big factors happening around them to impact what they're looking for. So I think values is so important. An organization needs to be very clear on its values, and it needs to really not just be seen as paying lip service to those values. And the amount of interviews that I do these days, and people actually talk to me about or ask me questions about what Zurich stands for when it comes to sustainability, about what we do for the community. They've done their research. They know exactly what we stand for, what we do, how we live it, how it plays through day to day. They're interviewing me. They're interviewing Zurich on what our values are. And that is critical for them when they actually are choosing. It's the work, yes, but it's bigger than that these days. So for us, I think values, first and foremost, as an organization, you need to be super clear on it, but you can't just be paying lip service to it. You really need to be living it, breathing it, talking about it, normalizing it. It has to be part of your culture, absolutely. And I think that that's something we do very well here at Zurich. And our values are very consistent across the world. So I've worked with Zurich in multiple countries around the world. I've been at Zurich for many, many years. And I can say that the reason why I'm still here and the reason why I keep on coming back, this is my third stint at Zurich. Every time I've left has been for not because I was unhappy, but because of other reasons in my life. Third stint back, the reason why I keep on coming back is because the values very much align with my own. We are an organization that knows that because of our size and our global reach, we have the ability to make an enormous impact on communities and on the environment. And so we take that responsibility seriously. We do a lot of work with charitable foundations for the community. We do a lot of work on sustainability. We committed to net zero way before any other large organization did. We see it day to day where we phase out paper. We have strict restrictions on our travel. We even ask our people how they commute into work. You know, there's a lot. We move our buildings into energy, green energy buildings. We shifted our energy providers to be green energy source. Like, these are real things that the organization is doing. And that's the proof points that people are looking for.
Yeah.
I think it's also hard these days to get engagement. COVID's changed things. I hate talking about COVID, but I can't deny that COVID has shifted the corporate workplace. Can you engage with people as easily when everyone is working remotely? No, you cannot. It is harder for us to demonstrate our values, to demonstrate the culture when everyone is disparate. Okay, so there is a reason why organizations want people to be back in office. And we don't want people, and I don't think anybody is saying that we're going to go back to 5 days. I don't think where anyone is advocating for a pre-COVID corporate world. We have learned that a work-life balance is something that is highly valued by people, and flexibility is highly valued by people, and we respect that, and we're trying to incorporate into the what does that mean for the way future. But yes, engagement and buy-in on that stuff, it is more difficult. As a people leader, I know that during lockdown periods or remote working periods, I have to put in so much more effort to be connected to people. And it means more spontaneous phone calls. So just give you a call, hey, Mark, how are you going? Checking up, just checking in to see if you're okay, how's things? Not a formal meeting invite where we sit down on Teams or Zoom and have a chat. That small organic conversation you would otherwise have on the floor when you're getting a cup of tea, when you're passing somebody's desk, having a joke with somebody about their weekend or checking in and going, oh, how's your mum? You know, she was unwell last week. How's she now? Like, that type of emotional connection that you have with people becomes so much harder when everyone's remote working. And so how do you maintain that level or try to keep that level? Huge amounts of effort go into that, because that organic now needs to be created. It doesn't happen organically anymore.
And just following on from that, you know, in that same ANSIP article you said, and again, I'll quote you, sustainability, technology, community, customers, innovation, we are all those things, yet we don't do enough to broadcast that to attract talent.
Yeah.
Here's your chance to attract talent. What would you say to those younger people who might be listening to this podcast and either just joined the insurance industry or thinking about joining the insurance industry?
Yeah. I mean, I never heard of insurance before I apply for a job in insurance, right? So people always talk about falling into this industry. All I have to say is, yes, you fall in. There's a lot of people that stay, and we stay for a reason. We stay because, not because it's a black pit, which we can't climb out of, but we stay because of, when I think about the reasons I stay, one is because I want to make a difference. I want to make a difference to the community. I want to do good in the world, right? I don't want to just make enormous amounts of money to make rich companies richer, to make people richer. That's not what I want. I want to do good in this world. I want to make a difference to people's lives. Insurance does that, okay? I'm in claims now. In claims, I call ourselves, we're the promise keepers, because insurance is a promise to the community that when things go wrong, we are there for you. And that may be for your car, your house, your business, yourself as a person, your own health, your own well-being, your family, whatever it may be. And claims is upholding that promise to the community and to our customers. So I love that I am in an industry where I am not just giving advice to businesses on how they can make more money or how to avoid issues. I am in an industry where I have a direct impact to the community and to our customers. And I love that. That to me is so important. I don't think we talk about that enough. I'm also in this industry because of the enormous opportunity. I've been in this industry now for 19 years and I have held no less than, 12 different roles, I believe. You know, I've changed jobs every 2 to 3 years. I said earlier, I get bored easily. I'm somebody that's very much motivated by challenge. And I love the fact that I can still feel every day like I'm learning. 19 years in the industry, and I am still like, wow, I didn't know that. Or I haven't worked that out yet. This industry is incredibly diverse in terms of, it is the full spectrum. There's finance, there's law, there's marketing, there's community-based stuff, there's customer experience, there's technology, there is everything. It runs the full gamut. And you don't need to pigeon yourself into, I'm a finance person, or I'm a marketing person, or I'm a legal person. I have held roles that have been in claims, in operations, doing big mergers and acquisitions, doing divestments, very people-focused roles, procurement. So I've done everything. I say everything, but actually it's still just a small fraction. There's still so much to do. But I love that. And I love that I don't need to leave my organization to do that. And I haven't had to leave the organization to work in Switzerland, to work in North America, to have projects based in Asia. So that opportunity that is literally at your fingertips.
I've got two final questions for you before we let you go. The first one is, if you were able to go back and visit little Susie Leung, who was sitting on that floor doing her sums, doing her maths, what would you say to her today?
That it'll all work out. To the teenage Susie Leung who was stressing out in her bedroom studying for her HSC, I would say relax. Turn on the TV, watch a little bit of those Sydney Olympics that's taking place literally like 1 kilometre away and you're ignoring the whole thing. I would definitely say relax to the teenage me because I was so anxious and stressed about making it, okay, and so concerned about letting down my parents or not fulfilling their dreams. So for the teenage me, relax. For the young me will be, you will have fun whilst you're achieving great success. Yes, I'm so thankful for the career that I've had. It's been a lot of fun, a lot of opportunity, a lot of fulfillment in terms of making a difference. And it's been a great career as well, right? So, you know, it's been an office job that ticked my parents' boxes, but it's been one that's been it's been fulfilling, but it's also been very financially fulfilling, career fulfilling, but also personally very fulfilling as well.
And also you meet some fabulous people along the way, right?
Absolutely. I love the fact that I am still in contact with people that, like the first ever person that hired me into insurance, we still catch up, we're still in contact with. People that I managed before that have now left, you know, the industry even, we catch up. We're actually catching up at Easter with our respective spouses and children. And it's these connections that you make. And that's the biggest thing for me, is just the people impact. So the impact I've made in the community for our customers, but also the impact that I've made as people who have impacted me through colleagues and networks and relationships.
And final question to you, Susie. What's next for you?
Great question. And to be honest, like I've said many, many other times, I've never had a plan, Mark. I actually never know what I'm doing next. And sometimes that has freaked me out. Sometimes that I've been like, I should have a plan. I really should have a plan. But I'm somebody that is very much guided by what I'm passionate about, guided by opportunities that suddenly arise. And in all honesty, they always materialize. They always have materialized for me. I like to, what I say, feel the fear. If I'm not scared of taking something new or starting something new, then that means that it's not the right thing for me. So this is actually my first life insurance role. That was a big scary moment when I considered leaving general insurance to come into life insurance, and it was to be the chief claims officer of an area where I was like, okay, post-Royal Commission, there's a lot here. It was also on the brink of a really big migration integration because we had acquired company. So that was really scary. I love feeling that, you know, I love those challenges. So what's next is I don't know until it happens, generally, is how my career has gone to date. And I have reconciled myself to being okay with not having a plan. Worked out well for me so far. And yeah, when you know, you know.
You're preaching to the choir. I totally agree. And, you know, the reason in my case is because you do not want to shut yourself off to opportunities.
Absolutely.
I mean, if I
Absolutely.
Said to you 5 years ago, you're going to be in the life insurance area, you would have said, mate, you're on drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because my husband is somebody who needs a plan. He's usually been the person saying to me, going, well, what's next and what's your plan and what's your doing? And I was just like, I don't know. It'll work itself out. I am an absolute optimist in all things. So I'm always like, it'll work out. It'll be fine.
And it has been. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on Business Made Personal, Susie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.